This Washington Post Live podcast is sponsored by the Barbara Lee Family Foundation, advancing women's equality and representation in American politics and in the field of contemporary art.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the Post's newsroom to life on stage.
On Thursday, November 15th, The Washington Post brought together current and newly elected lawmakers, top political strategists, and experts to evaluate the midterm election results for female candidates, discuss differences in party performance, and look ahead to how women will help shape the policy agenda of the Trump administration, the 116th Congress, and in state capitals across the country. In this segment, Washington Post politics and accountability anchor Libby Casey moderates a discussion with five newly elected female members of the Democratic freshman class. The representative elects reflect on the races they ran in 2018 and the challenges of campaigning and serving in office as women. They also outline legislative priorities, including potential plans to use subpoena power to probe the Trump administration.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Libby Casey. I'm the politics and accountability anchor here for the Washington Post, and we're so fortunate tonight to have this great group of newly elected Democratic congresswomen with us this evening. Thank you to all of you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
They apparently need virtually no introduction, but let's just go down the line and remind everyone who we have here. Starting at the end over there, we have Representative-elect Veronica Escobar from Texas, Representative-elect Chrissy Houlihan from Pennsylvania, Representative-elect Ilhan Omar from Minnesota, Representative-elect Jennifer Wexton from Virginia, and finally, Representative-elect Ayanna Pressley from Massachusetts. It must feel so good to hear that.
Very surreal.
Mouthful.
I do want to let you know that we also reached out to every newly elected Republican congresswoman, but due to caucus meetings, none were able to attend this evening. But we do look forward to continuing this conversation with GOP members next year as the 116th Congress swings into full gear. So let's begin. I think we all want to hear how this week has been for you all, but first, let's see if we can make a little bit of news, because welcome to Washington. This is what we do here. Let's talk about Leader Pelosi and your support for her. And I know that some of you have talked about how the only people interested in hearing about this on the campaign trail were the media, but now you're in Washington, and it's not just reporters who want to know the answer to this question. So,
are you sure about that?
Well, I think Leader Pelosi would like to know.
Sure.
And some other people who are potentially interested in leadership would also like to know. So let's just go down the line and say, do you plan to support Leader Pelosi for Speaker?
I do. So I'm an engineer, and I'm a terribly analytical person, and I'm kind of waiting to see what my choices are and what the platforms are that each person is running on. And right now, that appears to be one person. Mm-hmm. And so I'm working to understand the platform and the changes that are being proposed and presented, and I will make my decision when I need to.
You sound like you're still running for office. Very politically
savvy.
I think
it's a very important decision. I think it's one of the more important decisions that we all make, but it's like every other vote that I will be making, which is needs a deliberative thought process, and it needs to be, you know, done carefully.
Okay. That's right. Very nice.
So right now I serve in leadership in the Minnesota House as the assistant minority leader, and when I ran, I made the pitch to what it meant to fit into a leadership group. And so I'm doing the same right now, looking at every single person who's running for leadership position and trying to think about what my best team would look like to help us accomplish the agenda we all ran on.
Okay. Congresswoman-elect Wexton?
I will be supporting Leader Pelosi for Speaker.
Okay.
I'm uncommitted, and like some of my previous sisters said, I'm deliberate as well. But I think, you know, something that I've said throughout the end of the campaign, and it still rings true, is that I would not hire a principal for a school if I didn't have a clear values or mission statement. I want evidence that we have taken into account the lessons learned from the 2018 elections. I think we have a mandate from this electorate to be aspirational and to be bold. And we have not yet, to my satisfaction, done a postmortem and an audit in that way. Given the historic nature of this class, I think that we cannot operate with business as usual. And so I'm looking to see whoever puts themselves forward, and I'll meet with them, how do they plan to be bold and aspirational and to honor this mandate from the electorate.
We've only got a couple weeks till you take your initial vote in the Democratic caucus on November 28th. So the clock is ticking. We heard from Congresswoman Marcia Fudge that people have come to her and talked about putting her name in the hat. How important is it to have a woman in that position, especially after this dynamic year of the woman? Would it be a big mistake for Democrats to not have a woman Speaker of the House?
I think we need a woman, honestly. I mean, we have a misogynist in the White House, someone who actually works against women's issues, someone who has demonstrated very little respect for women. And I think it's important to have a woman at the top.
I believe, as you were mentioning, and also as Ayanna was mentioning, that it is an organizational challenge to sort of fit the puzzle pieces together and to make sure that the team that you're collecting is a representation of the people, all of the people, with all of the diversity that they represent. Gender is definitely important, but other diversities are important as well, and so it's a holistic decision for me.
Do you want to see some new faces in leadership, in that leadership chain, regardless of where they fit in?
I certainly do. That's why I'm vigorously supporting Congresswoman Barbara Lee from California for Democratic caucus chair. You know, I hope to get to a point where we no longer have these firsts, where we realize leadership parity across the board. But we have never had a woman of color in a leadership role. And I think we're certainly long overdue. And I just admire her strength of conviction and appreciate her service.
And finally, on this topic in particular, you know, Leader Pelosi at her press conference today was talking about how many ads were targeted against her by Republicans, even in, you know, putting Democrats a lot on the defensive. Nancy Pelosi, you know, this person, if you choose them and elect them, they'll be the Nancy Pelosi in Washington. I know some of you dealt with that in debates and such. Do Republicans succeed in their mission of vilifying her if she does not become the next Speaker of the House?
I mean, what I think the Republicans do really well is try to make us believe their message and have us kind of always be on the defense. And so I don't want us to be in a position where we're making a decision that's about rejecting them. We should make a decision about what the direction of the nation should be. Like Ayanna said, we need to be aspirational. We have to think about the opportunities we have in restoring hope and optimism and kind of being really bold and progressive. And I think it is really important for us when we are thinking about electing leaders that it is about electing leaders that serve us well, that are going to bat for Americans and leaders that are going to hold this administration accountable.
So you're starting to have those conversations now?
We certainly are.
And I would just add that it's unlikely that Republicans would spend tens of millions of dollars attacking Leader Pelosi if she were not effective and good at her job.
Exactly right. Right.
Well, that's true. And I would also just add, you know, I'm not... you know, we're in no way like the current occupant of the White House who often presents things with a zero-sum game. I think it is very possible to acknowledge what Leader Pelosi has contributed, the role that she's played in these elections, the role that she played with the ACA, and to acknowledge that many of the attacks against her have been sexist. I can acknowledge all of that and still say I look forward to having a conversation and better understanding her vision for this Congress and for the country. When I ran in the general election, I ran unopposed, but I still campaigned. I felt I still had an onus to make my case to the electorate, so...
And I would mention that you had a little clip from Kyrsten Sinema, which is that I believe largely the negative campaigning, and particularly Nancy Pelosi attack ads, at least in my community, which is 50-50 Republican and Democrat, really fell flat. You know, really didn't resonate with people. I think people are tired of the vitriol. They're tired of the divisiveness. They're tired of the kind of business as usual politics. And I think that's why a lot of us are sitting on the stage today.
That's right.
I mean, I would add too. Right now, you know, there is a campaign that is anti-Pelosi, and it's not for something. Mm-hmm. And so for all of us, we didn't run against something, we ran towards something.
That's right.
We ran for hope, we ran for change. And I think that's where we're rooting this conversation in. We want to see what is possible for all of us. We might not individually want to be part of that leadership, but what we know is that we are leaders. We are elected to lead. And in part of leading, we need to make sure that we're bringing everyone along and keeping their hopes and aspirations alive.
And I think that, frankly, the sooner that we can get past this question, the sooner then we can focus on the issues that are critical to our districts and the issues that are critical to the country, you know, like criminal justice reform, dealing with climate change and a deteriorating planet, finally tackling comprehensive immigration reform, shoring up healthcare, making sure every American has healthcare. The things that each one of us heard on the doorstep as we were knocking on doors or as we were at forums. I mean, I don't know that I got more than a dozen questions about the Speaker of the House.
Five in 2 years.
Yeah.
Five questions in 2 years.
We got more questions here.
Spend more time talking with me about it tonight. Well, you make a really fair point that the sooner this process moves on, the sooner you can move to the next agenda items. As we talk about your agenda, how do you balance stopping the Trump agenda, the Republican agenda, also perhaps conducting investigations into what's gone on already in the last couple of years, versus some of those aspirational goals? Where is that balance point? I know I've heard some of you say we can try to do both, but 2 years goes by so fast, and there will obviously be tough gridlock faced when you try to get legislation over to the Senate, the Republican-led Senate. So how does that balance work out?
Yeah, I mean, so I would say the balance for me has been always thinking about this work that we have to do in leading the resistance, but also in insisting on a set of values. And I think that there is an opportunity for us to have oversight, to take this administration to task, but also remember that we have work to do on climate change, that we need to have reform on our immigration system, that we have an opportunity to maybe even work with this administration on getting an infrastructure bill, expand our democracy. So both of those things can happen because we are people who recognize that it is important to fight. But it's also important to bring people along and get things done.
Let me be clear. The country is polarized not because of differing ideologies and ideas. The country is polarized because of the flames of hate that have been fanned and emboldened by the current occupant in the White House. That's what has polarized this country. I think ultimately, if you look at an issue like gun violence, that is suburban, urban, rural, that is transcendent and deeply resonant in every district and for every community. Infrastructure, childcare, transportation, all of these things are you know, relevant to every community. And what I'm looking for is that in that first bill that we put out, in addition to voting rights and ethics reform and campaign finance reform, which are all things that will restore people's hope in the faith of in our democracy, but that we are considering something like when we'll put a gun bill forward, mm-hmm. that we are being bold and aspirational, because I think we're at a point now, people live in intersectionality. I mean, that's become this buzzword, but I think for a long time we allowed elected officials to just talk about constituencies via a single issue. The fact that you support marriage equality is not the whole sum of the LGBTQIA community. The fact that you support reproductive justice and freedom is not the full sum of women. The fact that you support comprehensive and compassionate immigration reform is not the full sum of experience for immigrants. And I could go on. People don't live in big checked boxes. They live in intersectionality and in nuance. And we need to legislate in that way.
Mm-hmm. You know, what I heard consistently on the campaign trail is that my community is ready for governance. They're ready for a Congress that will govern, but that does include accountability. It really, truly does. When I served in local government, we had some very significant struggles in regards to public trust. And so we had to initiate some sweeping reforms in order to build that trust, but at the same time, we were able to invest, we were able to create really good projects and help shape the future of the community. If a community can do that in local governance, surely with talent and with dedication, and that exists in the Congress, we can get that done. But I think one of the things that people are hoping for, something that folks are hoping for, is that we will get things done. Mm-hmm. And I do think that if we expect to take the White House in 2020, we have to be able to show that we could deliver. But that also means on delivering accountability. And making sure that we don't have lawlessness at the top.
Well, someone in leadership has some advice for you, Leader Mitch McConnell, reflecting on the investigations of Bill Clinton, of President Clinton, back in the day, said that he was making recently, said, a historical observation that the Republicans' investigations of Clinton improved the president's approval rating. It actually tanked Republicans. And so he said that Democrats in the House will have to decide just how much presidential harassment they think is a good strategy.
I think there's a huge difference between what Bill Clinton was accused of and what Donald Trump is being accused of.
Come on, obstruction of justice. Judiciary Committee is going to be doing a lot of work thanks for that subpoena and investigative reach and power.
We certainly have someone in the White House who's made a mess of our democracy, and we are bringing heavy brooms to clean it up.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's what I will say to Mitch. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the one thing statistically that's very different about women in leadership is that, one, they produce more. Sorry about the men. And that we are consensus builders. And so what I know to be true and what we are all aspiring to affirm is that the people sent us here to collectively work together to accomplish an agenda for the American people that is prosperous, that restores hope in our democracy, that gives people an opportunity to look forward to what is next. And so we are up for the task, right, ladies?
Yeah. I mean, I got into this race for a bunch of different reasons, but largely personal. You know, my daughter's LGBTQ, she's queer. My dad's a survivor of the Holocaust. I don't recognize my nation and the democracy right now. I'm very, very worried about our current administration and the president. But we are now roughly halfway through our conversation, and what I learned through the 2 years of the campaign trail is, yes, that's very, very alarming, and it is very, very worrisome. But what was clear from talking to constituents is we are a broken government. We're not legislating. And so we need to make sure that we're controlling the conversation as Democrats, and that means that we have to be legislating. And of course, it's a check against our administration, but we really need to deliver. We need to deliver on issues.
How far are you all in figuring out what committees you'll serve on and where your voices will be most effective?
Well, that's still ongoing. I mean, I know that will be coming up in a while, but you know, I am happy to serve wherever I can do the most good for the people of my district and the people of this country.
It must be an exciting moment to look at the committee, see what their goals are, talk to the people who will be expected to be the committee chairs, get a sense of how you could fit in into their conversation.
Sure, but I don't think the totality of our contribution or the demonstration of our leadership will be limited to our committees. I mean, certainly our committees will take up the lion's share of our time, but we all intend to legislate. And I want to say this, one of the reasons I ran is because the issue of gun violence specifically, which is an issue of consequence in the Massachusetts 7th, disproportionately, is that after the Virginia Tech shooting, a number of the advocates that I work with in coalition had approached Democrats and said, will you push for a gun control bill? And they said no, because there isn't an appetite for it. And that's what has to end. You know, I think we create the appetite. And I want to legislate and continue to put forward things, and you know, they may not pass the second, third, until the fourth, you know, time, but we have to put things out. So I don't define our leadership just by the committees that we'll serve on. We've got the bully pulpit, we've got our respective caucuses, you know, values-based and issues-based caucuses that we can join as well, and then we intend to write legislation too.
I received some great advice, actually a group of us, from one of our veteran female legislators who told us the story. We were having a delegation meeting, and she told us the story about the committees that she wanted right from the get-go, and she really had her heart set on them, ended up on different committees, and she said she discovered incredible new avenues for leadership through committees she didn't even want. And the advice that she gave those of us in the room was, look, you have great skill, you have great talent. Every committee you serve on is going to be a good committee, and it's ultimately going to be what you make of it. And I'll tell you, that gave me tremendous peace. It made me think about how the avenues that we will use in a different way, that, you know, even if we don't get exactly what our heart is set on, that our community will benefit in some way based on what we make of the committee assignment.
Well, there is a really cool sisterhood that's developed well before the results came in, where I think even if we don't end up on the committee you'd like to be on, that you definitely have channels to be able to talk to people who are young and fresh-faced and fresh-legged to be able to make a difference. And I think that you're right. We're freshmen. We probably don't get a whole lot of choice, but we're going to do our best to make it.
But I also want to say that, you know, I don't want to speak for my sisters here, but I would venture to guess they feel similarly. That this is not just about, you know, how we lead. This is about how we create space for others to lead and the new voices that we engaged. And I'm very encouraged and emboldened by the citizen activists. I mean, all of us expanded our electorates. In our race alone, 54% of our primary voters, that was the first time they ever voted in a primary. The Latino vote grew 71%. The student vote by Boston University grew by 400%. So, you know, I see those folks as being sort of cooperatively governing with me, and I want to make sure that the new voices that we've engaged, the hope that we've given or that we've restored, that we keep that and we continue to govern with them. It's easy when you're here to make everything about navigating the hill, but there is still work in community and in coalition to be done with our districts.
I have a great question that's come in from Twitter that really touches on this. A young woman who identifies herself as a student of color currently attending Ohio State asks, I've only been recently engaged in the political field, and I have a strong interest in running for office. What advice would you give me?
Do it. Actually, in all sincerity, when it became evident that my race might end up going favorably, it became a mandate of mine to make sure that we were, as a campaign, elevating everyone else, every other woman that we possibly could within our reach, to make sure that they made it across the finish line, too. And it's really, really important that we do that, but we've been to the Year of the Woman before. It was in 1992. And it just cannot be another year of the cicada when the cicadas sort of come up and then they disappear. I'm really, really worried that this is an aberration and then we need to make it a permanent thing. So I would advocate for this young woman to run.
You know, the other thing that she could do and that she should do, it's something that I did and it really helped me feel comfortable being a candidate. I volunteered for candidates who inspired me. And I got involved in campaigns and I learned how to canvass, I learned how to phone bank, and then later wrote checks. And I had to be convinced to run for local office when I finally did. But by the time I did, I had 10 years of being in campaigns as a volunteer. And so the day that I announced, I felt so confident because I knew what I was doing. And so I agree with Chrissy, run, do it, we need you. And even if you lose, try it again. Mm-hmm. But a really great way to get involved is support women or men who inspire you and make you feel hopeful. And even if they don't win their race, keep volunteering. We need you. We need that energy.
Representative-elect Wexton, did you have something to say?
Well, for me, my path to elected office was through public service. So my advice has always been to follow what you're passionate about, and then that'll lead you where you end up, where you should be. And that certainly was the case for me because I wanted to be a prosecutor and then I wanted to be an advocate for kids and then I stepped up because I saw injustice and I stepped up in electoral capacity and this has led me to this point.
Some of you talked about...
Oh, I was going to say, Veronica's story is the story of many women. Most women have to be asked to run for office. Statistically, it takes women 7 times to be asked before they say yes. And so to the young woman, we are all asking you
to run for office. Wait a minute, though, Ahmed. You didn't tell the most important part of that statistic.
Right.
Would anyone here venture to guess how many it takes to convince a man? Zero. Himself.
Himself.
And that's actually a data point.
Ayanna, it's his mirror.
Those are the facts supported by the Lee Family Foundation. I want to give a shout out to the Lee Family Foundation and Higher Heights for America and Emerge America and Vote Run Lead and so many other organizations that are doing that. But I would say this is probably unpopular. I don't personally think that everyone should run. I'm not of that thinking. I think the problem is that we've created this public narrative that there are only two ways with which to civically engage, to vote and to run for office. Now, I was an aide for 16 years, 4 years to a member of Congress, 11 to a United States Senator, and then I went on to serve on the City Council for 8 years. And that was the path that I chose. But if I had never run, I found great joy, meaning, and reward in being the person behind the person. People really underestimate the power of aides. They're the ones whispering in the ears of those legislators. They're the ones twisting their arms. They're the ones enlightening them because they're closer, you know, to the ground. And I do, this last thing I would say is that, you know, to your point about the cicadas, I'm very uncomfortable with this narrative of this woman's wave or a brown girl magic, a black girl magic wave, a blue wave. If there is a wave, it's not one we're riding, it's one we created. You know, victory isn't magic, it's work. And I think these narratives where you tell people that it's either a fluke and an anomaly or a trend and a wave, and everyone raises their hand and says they want to run because they think it's as simple as that. This is a lot of sweat equity. This is leadership choices. This is a strength of conviction. So this is not for everyone, but expose yourself to everything. I do agree with that.
Now, that being said, I've spent my whole career being the behind-the-scenes person. I've spent the better part of 30 years of adulthood being the operator and being the aide, effectively, the person behind the stage. It took every ounce of my being to do what I did for the last 2 years to get out of bed and off of Netflix and get my, uncomfortable. So what I would say is if this person is inspired to do it, this
Absolutely.
Person should try it. Because I never in a million years would have thought that I would be on this stage. This was absolutely anti-type for me, but it was so important. And we're in a time of crisis in our nation right now. And we need everybody to do everything they can.
Some of you have talked about the sisterhood that you've already been developing. You're developing, as I'm sure you were watching the returns come in for each other's elections and since you've been together this week, do you see ways to work with Republican women? Because that is something, especially in the Senate, that women have been able to do, go out to events together, have meetings together, caucus together, and spend time trying to find that unity across party.
I think it's really important to be bipartisan, not just with women, but with men as well. I'm a vet, and I'm part of another organization similar to the ones Ayanna was naming called With Honor, and it's a organization of veterans that are committed to working across the aisle. And I think that vets and women in particular have a reputation earned, I think, of being collaborators and team players. I'm absolutely committed that there are things that we can do, infrastructure, potentially even gun violence issues that can be worked across the aisle. And I think it's essential that we show the people that have brought us here that we have the ability to make differences and change.
Issues around childcare.
Most
of us are mothers or represent communities where that's important. So in the Minnesota House, my biggest allies for the first two bills that I introduced to expand childcare access for student parents in universities were my Republican colleagues. We were in the minority, and my bills wouldn't have gotten heard or passed as a freshman if I didn't have them rallying for it. And so it's important for us to recognize that we are here to serve our constituents, to serve the American people, and that there are things that we could work on together. And as Ayanna was saying, we might be polarized around this fanning of hate, but we are not too polarized around the critical issues that our communities are dealing with.
I'm willing to bet that most of those Republicans, or probably all of them, were not elected saying, I'm going to go there and I'm going to throw a wrench into the works and I'm going to, obstruct and say no and say no and say no again. So presumably they want to work across the aisle as well. And I came from, Virginia's state government where I was in the minority during my entire tenure. So every single bill that I passed was with bipartisan support. And you do that by talking to people, by focusing on issues that help kids and families and are going to benefit constituents, not just in your district, but throughout the country or throughout the state.
Let me ask you about a topic in the news right now. We've seen a lot of focus on Facebook and the power of the tech industry, the power of social media. Social media was so important in so many of your campaigns, a way to get out your story, reach people who might not know about you or might not normally vote, and they were inspired to come out and vote. Do you see that regulation of social media companies and tech will be a key part of your agenda in these next 2 years?
It has to be a part of the conversation, because we have seen really good, new, exciting tools via social media used in a way that has been harmful to our democracy. And just like we regulate other things, you know, vehicles or other tools, other things, I do think we need to take a very long, hard look at that and think through how to do it. We really have to protect our democracy. I've never felt in my life like I do today that our democracy is at risk in a way that just hasn't existed before, and social media has played a role in that.
So I'm, as I've mentioned, an engineer, and I'm also a veteran, and one of the bigger reasons why I ran for national office versus state office, having never run before, was I really am worried about national security and these issues of privacy, these issues of cybersecurity, and frankly, biosecurity are the things that keep me up at night. And so even though I don't get my choice of committees necessarily, I'm really passionate about those issues, and one of the reasons why I'm hopeful to get on some of those committees is to worry about legislating in these new territories, in these new frontiers like Facebook.
Leave us with some thoughts about this week and how it's gone so far. What are we not seeing? What do we not know about what your experience has been like? What surprised you?
Well, you know, the best plotting and planning still happens in the restroom.
My advice is eat when there's food available.
Especially now. There's a line for that members only women's restroom, but you know.
Yeah. You know, the thing, you asked a question about bipartisanship. There's a lot of time spent keeping Democrats and Republicans separate at orientation. And maybe that's not going to happen in week number two. But I almost feel, you know, I was talking to a few folks, like, we've got to find a way to get to know each other just as people, and to try to limit the amount of separation. I mean, obviously, for pragmatic purposes, your caucus has to come together. But when you looked at that freshman photo, you know, the freshman photo that you all saw us take, we haven't really had a chance to get to know a lot of the Republican members. Mm-hmm. And if we are really going to unify this country and work at finding areas of collaboration where on infrastructure or criminal justice reform or climate change, where we want to make positive change, we've got to have those relationships. And it surprised me that we didn't have that opportunity, but I'm hopeful that the new folks will figure out a way to make
Veronica's
it happen.
Veronica's exactly right. I mean, we can't do good business until we are in good relationship. And I know a lot of people have talked to me about the bipartisan workout crew. and things like that. But I did want to just share something that has been interesting. I do think we are ushering in a paradigm shift, and everyone is going to have to adjust in a lot of ways. You know, myself and several other new members several times have been escorted to spouses' events because people assumed that our partners were the elected officials. So I think that, and that has happened repeatedly. So I think, you know, it is a new day, and people will catch up.
Can we get some final thoughts from the rest of you about just how this week has gone and what your hopes are for the next week or so?
I mean, for me, it's really just kind of being reminded, right, what an honor and a privilege it is to be here. And how, you know, regardless of what part of the country we come from, what our platform was, what party we represent, we are part of a very privileged group of people who get entrusted to lead this country. And, you know, in one of the freshman presentations, they talked about only, you know, 12,000 people getting the opportunity to serve. And there are, you know, members who are historic figures who are still serving.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I find myself extremely emotional. I mean, I ran into Congressman John Lewis, mm-hmm. and I burst into tears. And I said, "Sir, I learned about you in middle school," and the same goes for Leader Nancy Pelosi. Like these are people who we've learned about in the books. Maybe I'm aging myself, and people who we've all been glued to the TV, watching movies about them. And it is just really amazing to be part of a group that is making history, to serve with historical figures as well. And, and I asked some of the members, I said, when does it become normal to be around him? And they said, well, he tries to make, he tries really hard to make you feel normal. But it is, it's just knowing that it's a great honor, it's a great privilege. There's a lot of weight that goes with the responsibility that we have, and we can play the silly games of partisanship, but ultimately we have to do the work of the people, because that's the important part.
We're about out of time, but I wanted to give the other two of you a quick moment to say, Representative-elect Houlihan, do you have final thoughts?
Yeah, I had the opportunity. My parents retired to this community. My dad was Navy, but he also came here as a 5-year-old Holocaust survivor. And the last evening, 2 evenings ago, I had the chance to invite my parents to come with me to the Library of Congress dinner. And my father, from a 5-year-old refugee to a daughter who's serving in Congress, was just an overwhelming experience. And that's what is humbling. It's the beauty of our nation. It's the opportunity that we need to make sure that we preserve for everyone.
Representative-elect Wexton? It's
beautiful. I'm just so humbled by the whole experience and the amazing colleagues I'm going to have in the freshman class and beyond. This is a part of history, and I'm really humbled and honored to be a part of it.
Well, thank you so much to all of you for being here tonight. Thank you to all of you. I'd like to just mention, you can sign up for our campaign and elections newsletter, The Trailer, to keep track of who's running in 2020, and also the goings-on along the trail and what are the ideas shaping our political parties.
Already.
You can do that at washingtonpost.com/newsletters, and if you'd like to share conversations from this event tonight, you can go online to find us at washingtonpostlive.com. Thank you so much for being a great audience tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening. To hear more interviews from this series and other Washington Post Live programs, visit us at washingtonpostlive.com.